Good afternoon and welcome to this very special event which celebrates and showcases the work of the winner and shortlisted poets for the Ledbury Forte Second Collection Prize. We're grateful to Arts Council England for their very generous sponsorship of the Ledbury Poetry Festival, and we're also very grateful to Olga Polizzi for her support for this prize. So our first reader is the winner of the Ledbury Forte Second Collection Prize, Sandeep Palmer, for her collection Eidolon. Sandeep is Professor of English Literature at the University of Liverpool. She holds a PhD from University College London and an MA in Creative Writing from the University of East Anglia. She's published scholarly works as well as two volumes of poetry. She's a BBC New Generation thinker and co-director of Liverpool's Centre for New and International Writing. Sandeep Palmer.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for being here instead of going to the football. I'm tempted to do score updates, but I don't think it's going to be an issue in the first 20 minutes. Maybe not. So, really delighted to be here and really honored as well to have the prize and to be able to, more importantly, to be able to read with the poets that I'm reading with tonight, all of whom I admire, and I'm looking forward to your readings very much. And also to be able to support the Ledbury Emerging Critics Scheme, which is just such an important, I think, venture, and I hope will make us all love poetry that much more. So I'm going to read from Eidolon, and it's a book that's in 50 parts, short parts, and it was written very, very quickly, and an Eidolon is a kind of ghost or an image, but it responds very specifically to this idea that when, according to the kind of the mythical or the ancient sources, when Helen of Troy was taken, or when Helen was taken to Troy, rather, that actually she wasn't in Troy, that instead her ship was blown off course and she ended up in Egypt, but actually there was a kind of specter or ghost of Helen that ended up in Troy, who was kind of, you know, haunting the battlements as over the Trojan War. And it was an idea or a kind of a model, I think, for me, not just to revisit the classics, which is something that I've always loved, but to think about the ways in which women are themselves a kind of spectral images within society, where they come to represent certain types of commodities, where how beauty is commodified, particularly as the most beautiful woman in the world. And there's after the 50 parts in the book, there's an essay which explains all of this much better than I can do now. But I guess one other thing I will say is that obviously ancient Greek myth is not something that's naturally part of my kind of available resources, because it's not part of my culture, and whatever that is. And I think I came to it really genuinely because when I was a kid, growing up in a very poor part of a suburb of Los Angeles, that my mom used to take us to the library, and I was immediately attracted to a book of Greek myths which had pictures in it as well. And it was a book called Diller's Greek Myths. And there's wonderful photographs of like Andromeda, you know, chained to the rock and everything else. And for me, those became my stories. And they became the narrative around which I could really understand the world in the way that Grimm's fairy tales did too. So instead of writing about Indian mythology, which obviously I have some access to, I decided to do this and to think about Western civilization, war, capitalism, greed, etc., etc. So Helen appears in these poems, but it's really about multiple voices as well. So I'll just read a few of those. It was not me, but a phantom, whose oath, a variable star moldering in the reliquary, is doubt. I have not unsealed love, its taproot, mouthing blackness, nor seized the fairer woman to purge from her song. This hellhouse of primogeniture, bookish, and pale, quartering what is also its own and only rule, this fire, and the fire that comes from fire. Helen, dispirited, camera-bound, Helen fetching the paper from the front lawn in her dressing gown a lot of the time, and knowing when the phone will ring seconds before by the click of its current. Demigoddess, not woman, not God, disembodied like a bull turned over and its loaf thumping out, Helen, queen of never mind the time, of you can't run on gin for all the everlasting, and such moths, broiling airlessly in a sodium bulb. Smell of it on her front porch, lights on, home. Waking to a November morning, to pins running across a yardage of wool or headaches, the circular world disfigured by food. Corn cobs in the sink gleam like teeth up her spine. Hurry up, the bus goes, and its déshabillement goes, loaming on after it. I do not insist that we retain the old names. I would know you ever, light as the seed. Marketing the day-long detente for a sliver of profit does not appear to bother the kingdom of saints. Ascetics, her brothers, Spartans, whose only god is, insert here, the death of 11 days. Wash the man by the road who turns and seeing or not seeing is soundless animal. Wash him, he is your brother. Enter his encampment of fuel-scarred fabrics and listen to his black pronouncements, void of exhaust. Scramble up the highway's escarpment, inviolate, good. Wash him or be without brothers. Helen denuded, Helen a place of pallor where silk shrinks around her throat, exits the office, mindless, purposeless walking into and out of, through and over, up and around, into and out of, hands waving, mindless purpose, metal tint to everything, Stasikoros blinded for watching her cross the street, outside and into, the car, horn blaring. U.S. national interests. Matters of vital interest to the United States to include national security, public safety, national economic security, the safe and reliable functioning of critical infrastructure, and the availability of key resources. PPD, Presidential Policy Directive 20, top secret. It has, of course, occurred to me that this conversation is being recorded, but what you say does not anyway belong to me. The 1913 local prosecutor training manual warns no Jews, Negroes, Dagos, Mexicans, or a member of any minority race on a jury, no matter how rich or well-educated. The 1986 manual warns against those with multiple gold chains or free thinkers. As a wheel on its axis turns, this book unwitting to itself around the idea of thee, Whitman. Helen of Sparta, of Troy, in Egypt, of no known address, of no known nationality, refugee of no known conflict, stateless, without property, disappearing under a veil of treason. Helen is instrumental. Laws permit me to refuse your advances, although I have eaten the salt from your table. As for your hospitality, I like it anywhere just fine, so long as I'm coming or going. Helen is not all, but scattered like grain, vituperate, ghost meaning, to greet herself, to make room for herself at the table, to eat a meal of dry meat and vinegar. Helen is not vital. I am not the Virgin Mother lamenting in the hills above Ephesus. I am the invective, injuring these dry plains studded with stone pines. I am the lateral commemorate of war. As the steps up to my hiding place suggest, I am the birther of sacrifice, received back into the earth, heavenly rock face. If you knew my real name, you would not use it so lightly. An idea is not a woman, but many women, the composite of an idea. Ours is an older civilization, remade dramatis personae, recast by different troops, rebuilt in the style of Ionian capitals and fluted pilasters, put through the ringer of the magisterium. We see the real Helen is the false we, is the eidolon. Put first before the rest as light for all and entrance song of all, that of eidolons, Whitman. No one alive remembers the unrecordable warmth of my breath. Let us be as a city upon a hill, as a stone or several stones, as white shells in each city's layer, each layer a memorable human hour, gathering the sea and all its warble in the dust. If you roll into LA from the east, by car, by road, through oaks and sycamores that give way to studio lots, barred up like penitentiaries, dreams assembled stone by stone behind a forbidding wall wreathed by wire. If you enter from the air, descending through smog, its brown meniscus, watch the city light up like a motherboard on high alert, from the dry sanctuary between Vegas and mountain ranges, the bric-a-brac of cacti, the desert lore of cannibalism, and invisible tribes of off-the-gridsmen, rattling tinnily in the ears of cascading sierras. Let us be as a city on the stones of other cities. Troy, dignified and silent, draws a stratified cloak of nine kingdoms over its brittle shoulders. Its cape of stone has been smoothed by the humble footfall of its slaves and women. Stop and listen. As you stand high on its brow, hear the hot wind rush up the hillsides of brush through some sort of oak, we think. We collect its seeds to plant a Troy tree in our Californian garden. My mother, convinced it will live, unlike the pomegranate, fruitless, wanting some eternal myth denied by the Pacific. Biblical fruit, sole comfort of the dead, its globules of ruby life, 613 cells of blood that pour in the Babylonian crush of idle days and endless cruelties. No, it will not grow on my mother's lawn in an exile's confusion of lavender, red marigold, and lily flower. Mother, let us be as a city, rising, not swept through by the greed of rumored enemies. If you arrive by boat to Troy through quietest midnight, in the pre-blue of black, slipping in the tide past Lemnos, abrupt On the horizon, you will see the sun erupt from behind a panorama of cloud. Lighted scenes of warring gods, burning in their silhouettes, the carnage that burnishes gold, scattered without excessive note over the Trojan plain. Helen, as a beam of moonlight, caught sideways. Helen, refracted onto thresholds, her reflection a holy cult of high-born women ululating in bedrooms, gripping the mirror hard that bears her standard, Helen, with beauty like a tightened bow. The window clapping shut like an iron gate, she does the latch, empty, diffuse glow. Now focus on her lithe and loathed silhouette. See if it makes plain how a woman could be mistaken by so many men for a ghost, bartered dead by nudist song, even in this unacknowledged light, at this impossible angle. So that was from Eidolon. I'm just going to read one poem from the other book, because I seem to have a lot of time left. I'll read one poem, and it's a poem that I read quite a lot, actually. And it's because a lot of my research, at least used to be, now that I work on contemporary literature, less so, but it used to be archival. So in all the time spending in archives and thinking about archive theory, and knowing that archives embed certain types of silence and they allow certain types of narratives to emerge, I began to think of my mother's life and to think about how, even though my father told lots of stories about, you know, India growing up, et cetera, I knew almost nothing about my mother's life. For whatever reason, she didn't tell me. So I sort of imagined that her life was like approaching a kind of archive, and tried to work with what I knew. Archive for a Daughter. November 1972, Derby. A dance card embalmed in sweat. Her ruthless curve of palm, mowing the carpet into sheaves before a gas fire. Liquidescent virgin in a purple dress. Oil paint, shaded avocado, umbrella sun wings. Box 2, folder 20, early married life. A single page. Recto, a fashionable center parting. Verso, consonants, midnight, affair, nuclear, affair. Bleach, affair. Watermark, indecipherable. But here we are jumping ahead. The archivist notes that no exact birth date is known. An already Western-dressed six-year-old reads the headlines of English newspapers for party tricks. Her black eyes are blunt and unequivocal, like the prophecies of pharaohs. In a Punjabi village, she and her impeccable mother, gemstoned, oracular, Princess of Vernal Causeway. Box 1, folder 2, emigration. The BOAC stewardess's Max Factor crinkled baskets of sweets to soothe the girl's swinging, impatient feet. Aviation, a risky endeavor in 1963, levels a curse at her progeny, aerophobia, her own daughters, fear of the air between home and exile collapsing. Box 1, folder 7, education. Homeland's Grammar School for Girls. Miss Moore leans across an oak sea and parquets a line of future mothers, her bovine sympathies neatly pressed, tentacle towards the only Indian in the class. The Georgian battle cross marking her forehead kindly and thoughtfully segregates. The girl bounds wildly through the public library. Huxley, to her 11-year-old mind, suggests individuality, but the savage's feet recommend no one specific exit. Folders 8 through 17, unbound notebook, mostly unreadable. I thought I could become a doctor, and asking found I could not think to ask to become anything. The archivist notes that these pages are not continuous. Refer to box 2, folder 10, correspondence. A photograph of a prospective husband, and several handwritten credentials. Box 3, Folder 1, Notes on Motherhood. Nursery, pram, groceries, pram, doctor's visit, cucumbers and half-lengths. Over each shoulder, some conspicuous intellect. Husband, academic. Wife, typist. She door-to-doors Hoovers, Avon, thick rosaries of factory lace, while her children pop tic-tacs for invented ailments in plastic houses. Nottingham hurls snowballs at her black turbaned gentleman. Soaked typescript, fair copy of a life. When she asked her parents for a spare suitcase for an exodus, they replied, "My child, nothing is ever spare." Box 4, Folder 1, Exile. 1985, Vancouver. Ablaze with cherry blossoms from here to the kindergarten. We arrived with one steel pot, a bag of lentils, and an onion. Folder 2, 1987, North Hollywood. Submarine fences root Thanksgiving potatoes, one apiece. My daughter reads Laura Ingalls Wilder to her menagerie of dolls. Raft sails calmly on. Folder 3, 1989, Oxnard. Gifted children are purse strings. We mind their collegiate years with interest. El Rio wizens to a stockpile of citrus and rental agreements. Folder 4, 1995, Ventura. Bibled to real estate. Gold blazers cinch round a wade of blonde leathered adulterers. The neighbors tend their god plots of lawn and hedge. Box 5, Folder 1, Doctors Parmar. She saunas with the ladies of the Gold Coast, one Japanese ex-comfort woman, one savvy senora, gold-buckled and multi-franchised. Stanford, Northwestern, Harvard, London, Cambridge. And when my husband's sisters wept because I had no sons, I said I have two doctors, one of body, the other of mind, and sent my uterus via Federal Express to the village with my compliments. On the verso, written in ink, is a page from Box 1, Folder 8, misplaced. I remember clearly when I knew that I would one day die. I was on the toilet and I was 11. The bathroom was white and oblivious. Thanks so much.
Our next reader is John McCulloch. His first collection of poems, The Frost Fairs, won the Polari First Book Prize, and it was a book of the year for the Independent and the Poetry School, as well as a summer read in the Observer. His most recent collection, Spacecraft, was named one of the Guardian's best books for summer and a book of the year for the London Review Bookshop, as well as being shortlisted for this prize. John McCulloch.
Thank you for having me, and yeah, it's a real pleasure to read with some great poets. I've known Sandeep for a while, and I met everyone in person now, and they're all lovely people as well as fantastic poets. I'm going to be reading mostly from my second book, Spacecraft, which was the book on the shortlist. It's a book which is all about emptiness and absence and takes different viewpoints on them, and particularly it's called Spacecraft, is it? Thinks about them as creative forces, as things which make things happen in the world. The biggest absence in the book is my first partner, who passed away a number of years ago, and a long central sequence in the book reflects on my time with him, and I'm going to begin by reading a few sections of that poem. I've carried a door on my back for 10 years. You lugged it from the builder's yard. Now it's my turn to know its stiff weight. the slow chafe of pine against vertebrae. A decade-long kiss, flush with splinters. I closed it when I left. The lock snicked. Then I noticed it hitching a ride. It never gives up. Patchy blue, invisible straps. A faint knocking, though nobody's there. So many slab hazards. Repeated thumps to my skull. Brass hinges clouting strangers as we creep into lifts, beds. I lie awake on its panels, framing rectangular thoughts. Obsessed by the side I can't see. What grows there? The problem is, you died, so there's no way to set the thing down. No wall to prop it against, with its stuck handle and fracturing paint. All day, we continue our back-to-front tango. This dance where I almost but never arrive. Where I'm shut off to visitors for hours. Then, with one touch, swing wildly open. Hall. In Minnesota, they reeled a 60-ton house over ice, a caught fish. The tow truck eased forward. A steel cable stretched and quivered. Walls crept. Why it sets me thinking of you, I can't fathom. Who'd rescue your building? Split gutters, bleedings from oxidized pipes. Still, I picture it skating, its porch nosing the air. The house where you swallowed your diagnosis, where you phoned from, drunk. It plunges through ice to the lake's silty floor. Brown water discovers its rooms. Algae, furs, chairs and bedposts, traces circles on ceilings. The loft crowded with minnows, a wandering bass. Some days I'm visited by a church of rain. The building wanders around the sky, then falls on top of me. Clouds are its ceiling, droplets the choir. Inside, stones achieve the ardent shades of stained glass. Jagged pines melt and glitter. The broken air remembers, and I listen in the steam and hiss of psalms for voices I have lost. I dream of striding down the pavement's dazzling aisles for years. Then I meet the clean smell left behind. Recall how only through forgetting can the church arrive. And I come back to my small garden. Its chalky earth, young, forgiven. So it's not all doom and gloom. Spacecraft has a number of different takes on emptiness, absence, and nothingness. And some of them poems in particular explore punctuation, which has always been a bit of a thing for me. A number of the poems just have like a strange punctuation mark or letter as the title. This one's probably my all-time favourite punctuation mark, which is the exclamation mark. It's the first poem in the book. And the exclamation mark is something which creeps into most of my emails and text messages, whether I want to or not. I remember when I had some poems accepted for The Wolf many years ago, looking back at my reply to them and seeing that I'd used loads of exclamation marks and probably a little kiss at the end. So it's something that just happens. This poem, no one knows the exact origins of the exclamation mark. It pops up in England in medieval times, and it's thought that it might be the Latin for joy, io, an I on top of an O. that might be the origin of it. But anyway, this poem kind of goes back to medieval England, and it's about exclamation mark the early years, really, which were a very queer time, as you'll find out. It appeared without warning, like an angel or injury, this tall mark of havoc, a pillar of fire. Already it is intimate with bishops, philosophers. I watch it flout borders, stowed in the peppered tails of sentences. It infiltrates vaults, prisons, the bedrooms of kings. I have tried to resist, but it steals from my nib, its saucy eye rippling in candlelight, dodging pumice and knife. The abbot disapproves, names it a feminine indulgence, the want of self-restraint. It's like the secretary who greets me each Tuesday, his hand travelling the road of my spine. His tap on my rear makes verticals govern my dreams. At night, I see one symbol on vellum, filling sheet after sheet, inscribed in blue light. My ankles vanish, and I live above my single foot. I find myself amorphous at the end of a terrace, waiting till I'm near him again. Recover my form and can say, here I am, a hot fountain in the garden of language, the scratch of the vanquished, those undone by the world, staring back, astonished at the hand that shaped me. Some of the other absences in spacecraft are words which have fallen out of the English language over the years. Quite a number of the poems are words from Samuel Johnson's dictionary in particular. This next one is called Flittermaus, which was an old English word for bat, related to the German for bat, Fledermaus. And it's one which we've sadly lost and which I would like to bring back. Flittermaus. That old English word for bat returns to me at sundown, beneath a screeching cloud. Shape zigzag while the moon watches, thirsts. I think of you with Samuel Johnson's dictionary beside a shelf, your long fingers splayed across the spine. Unable to swallow one entry, you squealed and burst the library's hush, then froze, astounded by the echo. You fled town 3 weeks later, disappeared without a text or email. Flittermaus, what happened? In which rooms do you track down words like insects now, combing books and specialist websites, open-eared, as you wait for your own strange voice? This next poem is another one inspired by a lost word. This time the word is flother, which is a synonym for snowflake, which appeared once in around 1275 in a work called The 11 Pains of Hell. And then it wasn't used again until the 20th century, so it had quite a long time undercover. But what with all the talk nowadays of snowflakes, it's one of my favourite words. Flother. There are hours when one dogged snowflake falls. Swoop, flother, through doors in the sky. Stretch your six arms out to wound the night. At the bus stop, a Greek nurse is a pair of compasses, tracing with one foot the circle around her days. Burn the dark for her. Be the word flother that slept on vellum for centuries, then bloomed beneath an archivist's glass. Little star, the ground is open like a book to catch you. Lead home those lost in K-holes. Foster luck. Show the failed suicide an ocean's sudden field of snowdrops. Then rest on flint as you dissolve. And he heads back to that sky where people glide together through unsettled air. This poem, it was the last thing I wrote for Spacecraft, and it's an elegy for a poet called Lee Harwood, who also lived in Hove like me, and who commented on the poems as the manuscript was growing. We used to meet up once a month and swap poems. And my own approach to certainly using spacing on the page has always been inspired by Lee's own poetry, of which I was a big fan long before I met him. Rooms. There it was again, the softness of your voice, the cushioned spaces of its hesitance, that constant search for the right way to question yourself. We'd met on Hove Prom by luck. You talked and I rested in your little rooms. So much sky, so many wanderers, we were already in a dream. Now I walk past beach huts, backwash, with no chance of stumbling into you again. There is only the silence of clouds, the air between shuffled pebbles, the gaps I listen for inside the rain. I'm going to now read just a couple of newer poems. And I'm working on a book that's coming out next year with Penned in the Margins, which focuses on queer politics and the body. And this first one is a prose poem. And I last year had an operation to remove some gallstones, which was terrible. But fortunately, I got a poem out of it, so it was worth it in the end. I was very worried I wouldn't get anything out of it. But it's called Stones. Rain makes me travel into myself. I lie in bed and notice things. How each fingernail is a screensaver of somewhere I've never been. A white hill beneath a giant sky of pink, ghosted with cloud. A country my hands have dreamed. I've fixed many names to this body across the years. Prophet, demon, Claude, once palace of failures. The mice behind the skirting sing like birds, I thought, but I can't hear them. The sycamores too, for all I knew. My body, what a vessel to be stuck in. What a gruesome vase that kept on dribbling through all its holes, so I had to rinse it every day until I died. Later, I found it harboured other cargo, stealthy freight concealed beneath my liver's right lobe. A crystalline accumulation, doubts that had condensed into certainties. I woke at 3 a.m. with an angular pain below my sternum, radiating to my back. I phoned a taxi with one hand clutched to my useless breaking torso. I thought of Carnia, Roman goddess of not just organs but door handles, how I'd grown one inside me and it was forcing me open. Surgeons expanded me with gas, used forceps to coax out my secrets. I came to as someone rattled peppercorns inside a jar. Enough there to build a house. Wounds made my body tight. My walking speed, roughly 0 miles per hour. This, however, is the stone of it. There was a door in the middle of the desert. I noticed things, snails sliding up walls, the shape of bricks, how a roof can talk with sky, how every stem and slab and footsteps assign you thought of a world that keeps imagining. I do not need another vessel to better comprehend the dark. I am already part of it, already sending out white hills to join leaves falling, to bump along with tuneful mice singing through the night, with every pebble that begins among a family deep inside the public earth. So I'm just going to read you two more poems now. This next one's also from the next book. My Bible is now a flock of paper birds. I needed the God of my childhood to be useful, so I folded him, shaped his pages into wings. Cranes at first, then more challenging roosters, swallows, owls. I pinched edges, split clauses to make word plumage. I fractured Leviticus with pleats. Now toucans mount doves on the kitchen counter, near an unholy pile of geese, cloacas gaping, beaks jabbing everywhere. Birds plummet from shelves without bothering to flap, remember nothing. Ink blurs, feathers yellow. They drown in baths, rip luridly, turn up mangled in the hallway, footprints across their necks. Mostly, they're individuals, seem smoothly indifferent to each other's fates, though now and then some prop up neighbours if they topple. And when I lie with a visitor beneath my quilt, incubating his glorious buttocks, the flock discover their throats and sing together while I guide my tongue along warm creases, and the tight sheet of his body slowly opens. So I'm going to read you one last poem from Spacecroft again. I'm doing an interview tomorrow with Chloe Garner, which is called Queer Language, which focuses on LGBT history, identity and poetry. And this next one's, I suppose, about Brighton, where I live, which is a bit of a queer mecca if you are LGBT and live in England. That's what I want to talk about. Okay, anyway. In the Angelfish Cafe, the woman who says sorry to chairs is pleased with her work. She's used her tray to build a city within the city. The teapot, her pavilion. Forks for piers, a ketchup church. I picture the cast of residents. Fire eaters who charm lushes in a park of crusted mash. Squatters occupying mugs. The spoon's shadow flecked with pensioners in latex shorts. Among the salt and pepper wreckage of the shore, bears and otters dressed as Dorothy poke charcoal and natter at their vegan barbecue, sidetracked briefly by a sugar bowl freighter. A circle of radical fairies begins to chant. The baby lesbian puts down her spliff, fidgets in her deck chair, convinced she's being watched, daring someone, anyone, to answer. But the creators moseyed off. I sip my lemon tea and gaze as the waiter grabs the corners of the ocean, and the entire city trembles and rises, floats away beyond the walls of the world. Thank you.
Thank you, John. And now Judy Brown. Judy's shortlisted book is crowd sensations. It was also a Poetry Book Society recommendation. Her first collection, Loudness, came out in 2011 and was shortlisted for the Forward and Aldbrough Prizes for Best First Collection. Her pamphlet, Pillars of Salt, won the Templar Pamphlet Competition, and she's won the Manchester Poetry Prize and the Poetry London Competition. Judy was poet in residence at the Wordsworth Trust during 2013 and at Gladstone's Library in June 2014. Judy Brown.
Thanks very much. I was totally chuffed to be on this shortlist, and I think one of the major reasons about that was to be on a shortlist with these other poets who I really admire, and I was really grateful for it, so thank you. I had some glasses, I need them. I guess this poem was actually, I quite like poems that have some connection with real time, and this poem was written kind of as my father was having a heart operation, which, as he explained to me, they stop your heart while they do it, which is obvious until somebody explains it to you, and then it's far too obvious. But I'm really delighted that it's now, just about now the football's on. Just about now they are stopping my father's heart. Of late, the aortic valve has grown sluggish, but all in all, it's a fine machine, a liquid full system, intolerant of blowback, logjam and tides. It's been running 8 decades, systole diastoling the miles with its engineered bass note. Now they are cooling his body to reduce its oxygen thirst while they work. At university, he studied the moody strength of materials. He knows there are reasons why moving objects might start to fail. On his lecturer's notes, he read upside down, argument weak, speak loud. Last night at the hospital, no one changed their tone by a decibel. They've told him, a heart like this, big and hidden, rumbling in its housing, will restart itself afterwards with a twitch. That's how it was with him, downing the tea at the service station, swiping the last of the egg with the little chef toast. Time to get on. The motorway sliding, as empty as it used to be, between the heathered shoulders of the fells. I'm going to try these, actually, see if first time. I discovered, which probably everybody else knows, but was quite news to me, that loads of the astronauts were first children. Or only children. And I don't know why that seems such an interesting fact, but it sort of struck me. And it's got an epigraph, Buzz Aldrin saying to Neil Armstrong, after kind of watching videos of the moon landing, that, hey, Neil, we missed the whole thing, which I kind of liked. The astronauts. Each one of us was a firstborn. It was winter then. Cut glass, solstice, daylight. The stars were just holes in some sky. The baby's room was the study, re-emulsioned in pastels. Its ceiling hung with the low fruit of mobiles. We were the first to come close to the moon. Family was learning to read the horoscope of your worries. Herod's fingerprint never far from the door jamb. We came to want to tip out into thin air, to follow no one, crouch in capsules. But the real action was back in the living room, you poised on your Draylon recliners, the show our stumbles in big shoes. So it came to pass. The nursery light left on over the blue planet. We fell home, boxed and bouncing in titanium. Re-entry, just a sizzle in the Gulf of Mexico. This next poem is called After the Discovery of Linear Perspective. And this is what happened after that. You gave us new places to hide. Arcades and piazzas are excavated from your backgrounds in diptychs and altarpieces just for the hell. Some of our local heroes turn out to be smallish men. They whisper to their spotted hounds while the eaves of their homes recede. Stairs strut and coil like tempters behind the colour-coded holy family, the bishops, the patrons, the endlessly bystanding centurion. We all toe the lines, the vanishing points, the black and white ostentation of flaws. Perhaps the molten paint matters more than what's painted. This has become one of your tools, a closeted flourish of show and tell. Yet I miss their warmth, the maidens and saints twisted to press at the picture plane, all breathy frottage and damp like flowers under glass. Come, technician, let us brush past the samey glamours of Joseph and Mary. Christ, there is so much air explaining itself in the back of your painting. Let's inhale its new space. Shout merely to gather echoes. Make gestures that astonish us. When I was at the Wordsworth Trust, I was kind of really fascinated by the way the space is corralled, and it's really homely, but it's also a museum. And there's something very strange about the bordering of that space and making it feel like a little home and thousands of people trooping through there every day. This is not at all about that, but it's perhaps about the same boundedness. And it's called This Is Not a Garden. The epigraph is from a book about Japanese gardens, which says, "This garden, in fact, may not even be entered." This is not a yard. This is a garden. New decking slatted over a tumble of roaches. This is a yard full of potted tropical flora. The lotus swimming in its own pool. Mosquito-eating fish guarding its stem. I can't know whether this is a yard or a garden, though we ate out here last night. The iPod snicking in its dock, soft lighting making silhouettes behind the trellis. This is not a garden, this outdoor hoseable sofa, or this bed where we never both sleep well. It is a sort of park, public in places, this marriage where amusements are scheduled and planned. This garden, this marriage, is divided into rooms. In some, others are welcome, like yourself. This yard, this marriage, this bed should be like a garden. So many topics victim to the secateurs. It should pass like a wave through the seasons, appearing to be young, or else gnarled, wholly taken by age. A man made this garden for me, whether I liked it or not. After I had gone, he let it go wild to armoured holly and hawthorn, the small beer of thugweeds. But in time it will settle, a wiry daisy meadow, well fenced. I have to say that Emma, in the discussion I had with her just before we started, gave me an additional worry that I didn't have before, which is quite a gift. And this is what I returned to her, because Emma told me that what could happen if you leave your back door open? But what could happen if you leave your back door open, which is what happened to me, is that a rat came in and was not discovered for some time, which perhaps doesn't say much for my housekeeping. And then I have to say, I paid for the rat to be poisoned, and I wrote a poem about it, which I sent to the New Statesman, and they paid me exactly the amount of money that I paid the rat man. But they never published it. And I don't know whether there's a moral in that or not. A trapped rat finds another kind of freedom. Weeks ago, Darren folded his latex gloves and sealed his icebox of poisons, and you have nibbled the pink sachets of pearlescent fresh bait, enough to bump off a trio of rat mafiosi. You scattered the empties, deflated as half-dissolved balls of bath gel, under the along with your coffee bean spore, under the stairs. When I come back, there's just you and me. I can smell your death the moment I unlock the door, cool and troubling in the air's petrolish byblow. Then I see you, pretending sleep on the sofa. Oh, Jesus, this sofa. Utterly visible, claws clutching the flex and the plug from the lamp. Perhaps you've started to mummify. A nice touch with the designer toxins I paid for to save my queasy stomach at having you snuffed. The little I do is acknowledge your body, inhale the bitter message of your end game of glacier and permafrost, roll you off the sofa blanket, knot you into black plastic's comfort, do the basic things one does for the dead. I spent a year at living two or three doors down from Dove Cottage, and it was really interesting talking to Polly Clark the other day about her kind of how Auden became so real to her because they had lived in the same town. And I didn't manage to write a best-selling novel about any of those things that happened to me, but it was quite sort of moving to find, to be sitting in Grasmere and reading Coleridge's notebooks, even the things that were written elsewhere, and you do find that you listen more closely to the voice in your ear. And one of the things, despite not writing anything saleable from that, I did start having nightmares, which, and of course, Coleridge had like horrible nightmares and then cries out in the night and is really upset that nobody comes to him. And here are some nightmares from Townend. The title is The Dive, Townend, January 2013. I could hardly move in the mornings in those first iced out months, spoken for by the hollow fibre freight of two duvets. It was drift and stream, some skull theatre played out in cold and necessary moves, where the devil lounged at my shoulder, not touching, but the stretch of his side blazed behind me, the numb happiness that beguiles hypothermia. When he left, I lay hours in a fisherman's silence, listening for some catch in the air, or cramped at snow whispers from cars on the A591, unable to grip sleep until the boiler's strum swam through the radiators at 6 a.m. I wasn't the only one trolled by horrors at nightfall, but the silver joy of insomnia scared me more. The immobility I was held to all winter, afraid to check the dials, afraid to see that I'd been down too long. I broke surface to bruises, a slovenly thaw. Spring was birdsong, loud as broken glass. I'm just going to read one more and we'll finish just kind of on the dot of four. I just also wanted to say that I really, really enjoyed the event this morning that Sandeep chaired about reviewing, and I think that's so important. And this is a kind of weak connection because this is a completely unimportant review, but I did really want to say how much I enjoyed it. I thought it was great. So I'm reading this. This was from a series of poems that when I was in Grasmere, it was so sickeningly beautiful, I really had to go and stay in some nasty B&Bs around the edges of Cumbria, because you have to kind of look at the frame if you're going to sit in the middle of the picture smirking. And this was the nastiest hotel and the most expensive, which makes me feel less guilty about writing a poem about it. Was this review helpful to you? There was a goat outside the window of my classic double, working a bald strip of tilted earth behind wire. Between us lay a 5-foot-deep concrete alley through glass. My admiration at its brown head and neck on a white body like two beasts severed and sown, and some prison dreams neither of us would divulge. In the bar, low sun glimmed off the sea. I couldn't get a seat near it. The men from the power station who could, as a squadron, turned their heads from the window to watch the TV above mine. For me too, it was hard to believe in the beach that stretched for miles on either side, like an adhesive strip ripped off something useful. Breakfast was an open bag of Kingsmill White, some soft croissants pouched in cellophane, plus one bruised pear, which I took out of fellow feeling. I had to get us out of here, away from the owners talking business in their sagging tracksuits, away from this disowned ground. It's hand-hot rain. Thank you very much for listening.
The next poet to read is John Clegg. He's a poet, as you would imagine, and a bookseller. His first collection, Antler, won an Eric Gregory Award in 2013, and his most recent collection is Holy Toledo. John Clegg.
I don't know if anyone else saw the spontaneous outpouring of joy among the nation's GCSE students who had AQA as an exam board earlier this year when they set Ozymandias not only for the final exam but a month earlier for the mocks. Shelley must have been absolutely glowing in his grave with the praise and compliments he received from the nation's youth and the curses that were thrown against him by the people who were studying under OCR, who were obliged to answer on Dalgett and Don Paterson. And rereading as part of these celebrations, Ozymandias, struck me that Boundless and Bear from the last line would make a cracking pair of detectives in a buddy comedy. Hence, the Ozymandias protocol. Boundless and Bear, two detectives, investigate who stole the trunk. They conclude that the limbs were defective, but the sculptor by now's done a bunk. So they pull in an elderly tourist to establish the dates of his trip. He is full of complaints, but seems sorest that a big head's been giving him lip. So they question the head, bare and boundless, sunk in sand which is deeper than thought. Your suspicions are all of them groundless, it growls. All your works come to naught. You are welcome to both kiss my sandy ass, then God help me, you'd better be leaving, or you'll find out what pull Ozymandias still has in the land of the living. They head back to lost pets and divorces, expense accounts which they can pad, bent DAs, heiresses with horses who have gone to the drink or the bad. And they keep themselves out of antique lands, where wind blows the dust into devils, where sculptors mock kings with their weak hands, and where only the sand's on the level. Thank you very much. I had the idea of this being about elk or caribou or some other large herd quadruped being tracked with microchips to sort out migratory movements, which a lot of people are using to track climate change these days. Signal. Her tracking microchips a rhythmic prickle, blossoming into a migraine after thunderstorms or when the herd slips under the invisible circumference of a cell phone tower posing as a bristle cone. I am indeed a bookseller at the best bookshop in the country, the London Review Bookshop on 14 Berry Place. If you want the phone number or the email address, then ask me afterwards. The great thing about being a bookseller is that there's very little work involved. This poem is called Shelving and is more or less a true account, but where it says I was doing the shelving, in fact, it was my colleague Gail and I was writing the poem. Shelving. The existing monuments form an ideal order. I can see right through the ground floor sash windows of 66 to 70, John Nash's first mature commission, into Montague Street. Cameramen were out this morning building continuity for Idris Elba's action flick from nothing, from the corner of a phone box, filaments of plane tree streaming in the sunlight. Do the leaves come shrink-wrapped? All I have to do today is re-alphabetize fiction. Two gents browse. I know that if they've questions, I can field them. I know that when the shelves are tight, there's certain books the other books bend back to find room for. The NSA, who we all know, keep watch on everybody who uses the internet, based in Utah, where they've commandeered an entire reservoir to keep their computers cool enough to spy on us all. And it must be a tiresome life being out in Utah. Milton's God. Omniscience rerouted into Utah, where each day the Bluffdale Reservoir lessens perceptibly from cooling servers, to the care of which the NSA farms out its schlubs. I want that schlub tending a server clump in Bluffdale before the weekend, comes the edict. Out the poor schlub goes. The daughter changes schools, which is tremendously disruptive. Trapped careerists have it worse, though. Gossip and small daily kindnesses sustain them, doubtless, through another lunch hour in Bluffdale, another evening falling in the canyon, where dark falls quickly. They leave to collect their soccer-playing daughters. 15 minutes thinking of them, and I drift into a sort of schlub pastoral, like The Simpsons. Empson said pastoral was a subworld, mapped precisely to the surface world, but stripped down, sprueless, as among swains or clowns, the same way data boils down to tendency. Pause Google history, Moore's plumber hunt, annoys the schlub shaves. I suppose there's worse make work, worse fates than ending up their joke or toast. Tonight I'll think of their small talk at secret potluck. So-and-so's promotion, worry lingering round name-redacted's meteoric rise. Main worry being, meteors don't rise. An American football poem. I don't have any football poems, but I have one American football poem, which gives the title to the book, and is pinched largely from Matthew Arnold. The field goal. Holy Toledo, Bill King hollered from the Raiders' dugout. Stabler fumbled. Casper had recovered in the end zone. And we are here, as on a darkling plain, swept with a sudden confused calm, as though the air horns all inhaled simultaneously. Where, below us, floodlit knuckleheads collide. Holy Toledo! And the field goal falls out of nowhere in the final seconds. And I'll just read two more. A poem called Peach Tree. As we all know, Rilke in the Sonnets to Orpheus, not in the Sonnets to Orpheus, Rilke in the Archaic Torso of Apollo, the torso sort of speaking to him out of its belly button. instructs him that he's got to change his life. Peach tree for Jack Baker. Things grow around particularities. A footpath dog-legged at a field boundary. A feral peach conniving with the angle of a roof to funnel sunlight through its leaves and pericarp. Jack said that certain poems could bend thought like that. The auroras of autumn, he mentioned. We can be sure that no one reads a poem Rilke's way. Now change your life. Bam! Now, presumably, change it again. You'd never get through an anthology. Really, to read properly is to buzz low over our future lives in a crop duster, throwing out stumbling blocks. I'd like to close with a new poem. One of the absolute joys of coming down here was having a very slow 2.5-hour train journey through the Fens, which I love as much as anything. It's like nothing in the world. But I suppose it's very like other Fens. And so this is a prose poem called Fen. The whole Fen seemed on a tilt, at an angle of about 5 degrees, on an axis orthogonal to the dyke path. It was dusk. Time and light were draining from the back of the landscape towards us. Over Ely, whose cathedral we could just make out on the horizon, it was almost midnight, and getting perceptibly darker. Where we were, it was still warm, about 6 o'clock. The remnants of sunset lingered impossibly. All that moved was a small girl, leading between stationary caravans her flock of named geese, whose daytime job was to crop the caravan lawns, heads cocked on one side, scissoring grass an inch from ground level, not snatching it up in clumps like ruminants. We knew they were named, because we heard her calling them, one by one, home across the cattle grid. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. And now Emma Hammond. Her first collection, Tunsk, came out in 2011. She's also self-published 2 pamphlets. She's performed at many events in London in the past 10 years, and she's a freelance copywriter and has taught experimental poetry for the Poetry Society. Emma Hammond.
Hello. Hate going on after John. It's happened a few times. It's the worst. This is called Lego. What we really need is a new sculpture made of Lego. Mr. Fanshawe, the social artist, is working on a huge pair of testicles to symbolise the rise of mansplaining in a post-feminist world. Here is the privilege, just next to the spermatic cord. Primrose Hill will carry the plastic, multicoloured testes as a kind of radical angel of the north. I close the tab and stare off into the distance. Am I even real? I say to the cat, but the cat died 4 months ago and does not know. I wonder what's happening on the Daily Mail. It is a woman from that show, about a show that is on TV, but also not at the same time. She has enormous breasts in Dubai. My stomach is an earthquake, the tectonic plates all shifted up. Magenta is the new turquoise. I'm generally surprised, but it doesn't last. Take this quiz to find out if you've lost the will to live. I have A, lost the will to live. My tweet about how Twitter is the last refuge of the lost souls gets RT'd by a semi-famous clown troupe, the Lost Souls of Didcot Parkway. Things are definitely looking up. The rain types hard on the window. In between clapping and silence is my best response. Mum is dying of cancer. She exists in a box. It is cold in there, in the utility room. A bright pink piece of salmon slides from the fridge onto her hand. Do you want it, she says. Let me give it to you. It has a month in it, but the expiry date is today. I don't understand, and I feel bad that I don't want the fish. I don't want it or the trousers. They are a good make. I don't want the trousers or the soap. Everyone gave her soap for Christmas because it runs out. I got her poems about the war. She talks about the snowdrops and those little yellow ones. Ma is an artist, really, a painter of storms. She speaks of gusto and billy-o, things blow a hoolie. She flattens her Y's to E's. Recently, she sits under a blanket and looks out across the garden, watching the birds behind the glazing. You can sell the silver on eBay, she says. I don't want the fucking silver, but it is a loose end. Your sister has earmarked the Chinese paintings. What do you want? I close her fragile body in a hug. We are boisterous in talk of corpse preparation. I've done it more times than you've had hot dinners, she says. You stuff them with cotton wool and tie their necks back. She weaves an invisible knot and yanks it tight. Words push their way out of us like fingers pointing toward nothing. It's hard to know where to. And her dead friend imported coffins from China. They took so long to get here that the bamboo started sprouting, so we're useless. We laugh about that and how he was the life and soul. She tucks her little feet into slippers. The worst thing is that I love you all so much, she says with a little blip. The clocks soon go. Remember how she used to make us dance a Kaylee in the wilderness? The fury running through her like scents. These are quite depressing. This is about when my cat died. It's all about dead people, this book. My cat is dead. His little vein wouldn't take the needle. He is under the ground in the back garden, turning to liquid. I taped up the cat flap with packing tape. I dream of him and enlarge pictures of his eyes. I don't know where he went. Soon, my mum will die and I'll probably feel guilty because I never phone her. Her limbs are thin as twigs from the cancer. She will fold up in the earth like a collapsed clothes dryer. I do the school run, then say hello to the man in the Viking shop and the little man from the mini-mart. They exist in my life. I can't. I don't know where they go. Trying to read Moby Dick, but the words keep skipping about. I think I have anger issues. Boring. Trying not to dress like a mum when you're a mum. A choice of shoe. A dream about an 8-year-old calling you a pig. The tree is up in the square. I don't. The nights are so... And everyone's married like defeat. Fire. Autumn is sexually attractive with its nakedness and pitfalls. Dads like autumn as they get to burn stuff, men stuffed with knickers. Scrabbling around my room in the darkness, he looks for his club. I nicked it and marvelled at the open women. I don't get it. He woke me up, but I threw it in a stream. He saw me at the Barbican later. He said, "Who is this gorgeous creature who is my daughter?" When I got fat, he went off me. I was not sexually attractive. After the hurricane, we went to his friends. Diana didn't smell of hospitals. She was a red-haired forest of breasts ripped from the ground by a storm. And I have also been like a soldier, efficient in my bubbliness, crops spraying mystery across the stubble of Essex fields, yellow with rape, choking on the oil smell of beech huts. And I have been, good as gold, named you wonderful, listened to your ideas while you stare out to sea, bobbing off on the black Clacton tide. Women, though, are worse, with their sideways glances and unspoken speaks, great hags with flaps busting movement into weekdays. Not as posh as that, nor oldie-worldy neither, mothers with their thoughts and waiting. Smoking in the out-of-date kitchen, one slipper flipping like a whale. Put it in the bin, she says, knocking back a shot from the microwave. I'll say fucking chickens whenever I fucking well like. We get tipped into lemon meringue and rolled around in the Hansel and Gretel or baked on croûte in our shells of bodies. She smuggles the sanitary towels past the men. I've got your bunnies, she whispers. My mother used to burn them on a fire. This is called Expert. Obviously, this is all about when my mum died. And also, I had just had a spate of deaths all across 1 year. And this book was going to be completely different, and then it turned into this book just about people dying, things dying, which was quite bizarre, really. It wasn't really how I wanted it to turn out, but you don't really have a choice, in a way. So this was I wrote because she, the last thing she ever said was, "I am an expert, you know," which which is quite like fitting for my mum, because she thought she knew everything about everything. So she actually just said that and then died in the car. So it's quite bizarre. So it's called Expert. My hands rest on the wood like two small squid, ragged and cramped from the biting. You have been dead for exactly 1 week, and if I think about it, my mind will not. Podgy in a grasp of fingers, rough as terrain from binding, fending off ghosts on the night ward, and prank calls to enemies, you cup my face in them, drunk on it. You're my chicken, you say, and I pummel your creaky feet, the two small boats that sailed you across the surfaces of broken mirrors, towards laughter and gin, duets in the sun, pookie, soda stream, battle axe. How are you disappeared, my magpie, bright paradox, expert of experts, all conjurer of love, absent, yes. Lemonade. The Russian handyman found a grot mag under my bed. The headboard is loose, you need lemonade in the floor. Lemonade? Who even reads pornos anymore? It's not the 80s. I went to a cafe to escape, but the woman said, "Are you all right?" in a way that made me think my mouth might be doing that crisscross thing like in anthropology when the teacher said, "You look confused, what is it?" My resting face sort of awful. And my landlord with the spiffy clothes says he's disappointed in me and wants to deconstruct our relationship, but I can't take it. Seriously, fungus lingers under the floor. I'm ejected into the winter. Laminate, well, we could all do with a bit of that. My breath exits my mouth and I'm aimless, hobbling up a hill on ball bearings. Time to change my paradigm, says the TikTok. Not fucking Sylvia Plath. Too much of a pussy to put my head anywhere near an oven. Nothing. Sergey found a rat's bed. Remember that time you woke up with your trousers down? Yeah, well, every girl does. You're not special. Has this been really depressing reading? I'm just looking at the poems thinking, what can I read that isn't about someone dying? But this is about my friend who commits suicide that same year. So it was just a shitty year. It's called Troubadour, and he was quite a brilliant mathematician. He just loved math, and he was really just very clever man. No formula predicts the occurrence of primes. Your random visits, barefoot towards the end of the earth, became infinite, the leaded pipes of a loaded dice. As you grew larger, you became scarcer. The distances got wider. We upset you with the song Winter, careless the lines about restoration, Stone Canyon, cold, cold. You would not be pigeonholed. Gentle crown of curls around the pinkest moon, only as odd as the world beyond, refraction caused by the crystals of a magic garden, the silver gold chains of a fierce intelligence, your wizard burden, yet, duke of complex steps, our Romeo and Juliet of the ringing woodlands, renouncer of sable, vair, pact, indivisible. I do one more. Shall I try and find a fun one? Yeah, this is a happy poem. Called Interchange. Beautiful girls serve coffee in shops as orchids. Golden hair and excellent people skills, rare faces, wondrous tundras, goblet drums, sugar so chirpy. The woman in the co-op's knowing smile, I love her. And sawdust man in the pet shop fires out fiery fish to passers-by with dying eyes, battening down hutches, tending to the marrow bone. This plus the kindness of milk, the human of everyone, scurrying army of excuse me, a glove on a fence waves neon into the morning, lost marbles and laughter at the glass English voices, there is no gap, Elvis on the night bus, the flicker of ubiquity in all things, lunatics on street corners, and Mr. Metcalf in his mum's pink socks, filming his wonder tales, diatribes, all fronting to salute the beautiful how. Thank you very much.
I I'd like to say a huge thank you to all our poets, and also to congratulate them on being here and being part of this event. It's been fantastic to hear these poems. And so now we have gifts for you. So thanks to our stewards, Angela and Nick, and to Greg, who's been on the... and Matt, who's suddenly hit set up, who've been our technical crew this evening, this afternoon, sorry. And books will be available at the back of the... are available now for you to buy, and I'm sure the poets will be happy to sign them. And I just draw your attention to some festival merchandise, which is also on sale, the marvellous special edition Emma Bridgewater mugs and the anthology Huat, which is was published 2 years ago and is now magically discounted to £5 and is a must-have as a memory of 20 years of the Ledbury Poetry Festival. So thank you all very much for coming, and thank you once again to our wonderful poets.